Undercurrents, the hidden knowledge of groundwater. A production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. Hello again, this is Dr. Chris Bocast. Along with being a musician and a media provocateur, I am also a trained sensory ecologist. Sensory ecologists are interested in the subjective perceptions of organisms and how they interact in the environment. This perhaps makes us more keenly aware of the subtle prejudice of our all-too-human senses. Indeed, much of our progress in understanding the biogeophysical world through science has been a slow process of overcoming our own perceptual limitations. Fortunately, people can be quite clever when they put their minds to it, and in the past few decades, we have been developing technologies that can delve into and decipher realms that have hitherto lain beyond human reach, and even beyond human imagination. The realm that we shall explore in this series has its roots in our most primary needs and has enchanted human thought long before we gained the skills to record how those thoughts even came to be. This domain is hiding in plain sight underneath our feet, but to show you the importance that humans have always bestowed on it, I'd like to take you first to another place in quite the opposite direction of Earth and of science, a place lost in time, myth, and sky. We go to Asgard and the halls of Valhalla. In the great hall, the Norse gods are feasting and drinking mead, as is their wont. But Odin stands apart. He is silent and broods. Odin is the wisest of the Æsir pantheon, yet this god is uneasy. He knows that ultimately their ancient enemies, the Frost Giants, will someday overcome them, and both heaven and earth will be destroyed in the final battle of Ragnarok. He must do everything in his power to delay that apocalypse, but there is too much that he is uncertain of, too much he does not know. So Odin makes a decision. He leaves the festivities, strides from the hall, and dives down through the clouds, down the world tree Yggdrasil, down to the very roots of the world, to the Well of Urd. These hidden waters are known to grant wisdom to those who drink them, wisdom as much as can ever be apportioned to gods or men. But they are guarded. Mimir the Wise bars the way. Mimir is a shadowy and mysterious being, the only one allowed to dispense the miraculous water, and he is sparing in his bequests. Odin makes his case, and Mimir stands long in thought. Finally, he stirs and says he will give Odin water from the Fountain of Knowledge, but on one condition. Odin must give sacrifice. He must surrender an eye in return. No one knows how long Odin took before making his terrible choice, but ultimately, he gouged out his own eye and dropped it into the well. Mimir dipped his drinking horn into the chilling water of wisdom and gave it to Odin. The now one-eyed god gained discernment to forge new strategies to keep his kingdom and his subjects from destruction, at least for a while. Foremost in his plans was the decision to bring knowledge to humans. Well, it must have worked. The Frost Giants haven't gotten us yet, But there are other new giants tied to climate that trouble our feasts today. We have learned much that was concealed, stories long sealed in rock and seam, where water flows uphill, rivers boil, and the past can change. Come along as I try to retrace the journey of our understanding of water beneath the earth, and meet some of the people who are actively in pursuit of the hidden knowledge of groundwater. Episode 1, What Lies Beneath. In the last series I produced for the Water Resources Institute, Aquifers and Watersheds, I addressed many of the basic aspects about how we think about the natural distribution of the water we use. It was a lot of fun, though I did almost freeze to death making the final episode. Still, there was something that nagged at the back of my mind. Something that Fred Madison, Dr. Dirt, had mentioned towards the end of our conversation.
If a river or a stream gets contaminated, it's relatively easy to identify the source of the contaminants and then to do something about that source. Stop it, clean it up, whatever. We can do that. And the result of all of that is dramatic increases in surface water quality if you simply take away the source of stuff running into the water.
Water will clean itself up with natural processes fairly fast, at least on our timescale.
Well, if nothing else, it just flushes it out with a good rainstorm. But on the other hand, stuff percolating down to the groundwater that carries contaminants with it, not much happens in the groundwater system. It's very difficult. If we push a lot of nitrates into a particular aquifer, they don't go away. They stay there. We really don't have the ability at this point to fix an aquifer if it gets contaminated. And I think that's a very serious concern, very, very serious, with chemicals and fertilizer and animal waste and all kinds of stuff. We put a lot of pressure on the soil to do a lot of treating for us, and in some places we exceed that capacity, quite frankly, and that means that stuff's going to go to the groundwater system, and we don't know how to fix the groundwater system.
Not yet, at least.
No.
So how much do we really know about groundwater, and how should we think about it? Those questions naturally led to wondering about how people came to know what they know about the hidden waters around us. And given Fred's words, what is the current extent of our knowledge? What advances are being made? As the beginning excerpt from Norse myth demonstrates, humanity has an ancient appreciation of the existence and power of groundwater. This predates history itself. Knowledge of where water lay under the surface could literally mean the difference between life and death if the rains did not come. Our oldest myths abound with tales of sacred springs and lakes possessed by spirits whose strength was rooted in their secret knowledge of hidden waters and whose magic demanded respect.
Well, how'd you become king then?
The Lady of the Lake, her arm clad in the purest shimmering samite, held aloft Excalibur from the bosom of the water, signifying by divine providence that I, Arthur, was to carry Excalibur. That is why I'm your king.
Now, you may find that all a bit fanciful.
But you can't expect to wield supreme executive power just because some watery tart threw a sword at you.
Still, ask yourself if you've ever thrown a coin in a fountain and made a wish. I'll bet you have. You did what people across the world have done since time immemorial. From the Celts of Europe with their holy wells and lakes, to the Mayans in Central America with their mystic cenotes, to the Hindu in India with the sacred river Ganges, they all cast offerings into waters that held special significance to their culture. One of the oldest continuous examples of this practice is held in India every 12 years, where the blue waters of the Ganges meet the green waters of the Yamuna. Called the Maha Kumbh Mela and timed to a specific set of astronomical alignments, it honors spiritual forces that cause the mythical underground river Saraswati to boil and mix with the rivers above. A ritual bath in the Ganges at this time is said to cleanse you of your sins. In 2013, the festival drew in one day over 30 million people, making it the largest human gathering ever on Earth. This idea of purification and forgiveness through immersion in water is widespread in human thought. It's intriguing to think that that same water cleanses itself of impurities as it cycles through the ground. But back to our story. People of previous eras may not have had the advantage of the accumulated and accessible body of scientific knowledge that we possess today. But they were quite observant, and they certainly weren't stupid. Not all of them, anyway.
Listen, strange women lying in ponds distributing swords is no basis for a system of government. Supreme executive power derives from a mandate from the masses, not from some farcical aquatic ceremony.
It goes to reason that there must have been some curative process going on. We know that a few people will survive even the most heinous diseases due to genetic luck and circumstance, but there's more at play here. Medical practitioners to this day remain confounded by the placebo effect, where if someone is given a treatment they are told will work, a certain number of them, usually 20 to 40%, will report some relief from the symptoms of illness, even if the placebo is only a sugar pill. If you feel better, you are better, at least for a while. Given the lack of effective therapies in times past, a 20 to 40% success rate was probably quite respectable. Yet another thing about human thought patterns remains a challenge for doctors, scientists striving to do valid research, and, to be honest, everyone. I'm talking about confirmation bias, the tendency to only recognize data that supports your hypothesis and to disregard evidence that would indicate the hypothesis is false. People remember the miraculous cure and forget the 10 others who weren't so lucky. Hucksters to this day take advantage of this and can easily manipulate suggestible audiences, particularly if they plant a few conspirators in the crowd. Conspirators guaranteed to loudly be healed or otherwise confirm whatever miracle or snake oil the shyster is selling. But digging deeper into the secrets of groundwater reveals some remarkable facts. We now know that the water in many springs putatively known for healing properties can accumulate trace minerals underground that do indeed have some efficacy in treating some sicknesses. By the 18th century, medical practitioners were organizing the known effects of many of these curative springs into what became known as hydrotherapy, prescribing various waters as treatments for ailments. Often, in the case of chronic conditions, these water cures proved very effective. Iron-rich waters were used successfully to treat anemia. Springs that had collected sulfates underneath the earth were used for gastrointestinal complaints, and a common condition of swollen thyroid glands, known as goiters, could be cured with water containing trace elements of iodine. As the science of chemistry progressed, these waters began to give up their elemental secrets. But there may have well been a prophylactic component to these water cures, as I will explain. One of the most interesting cases of water cures involves one of the truly great observers of the 19th century, Charles Darwin himself. Some listeners may recall that Darwin was infamous for enduring a mysterious malady his entire adult life. Beginning when he was 22 years old, Darwin became extremely ill just before his famous voyage with the Beagle, and he periodically exhibited a host of symptoms until his death. These included chronic fatigue, severe bouts of abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, headaches, insomnia, shivering, depression, anxiety. There are many, many more. Small wonder he was depressed. Darwin, an assiduous letter writer, left detailed testimony of his distress in his correspondence with colleagues.
I've been for 5-6 wretched days. Miserable for only tonight. Unable to do anything.
Such periods could stretch much longer.
For 5 months I've been knowing about this sick.
By 1849, Darwin was reporting he was ill one day out of three and turned in desperation to a Dr. James Gully for his aqueous treatment. Along with doses of water from specific sources, the doctor put Darwin on a regimen that included no work, regular exercise, and further, he imposed a strict diet.
No bacon, no butter, nothing.
Butter, bacon, and all the rich sort of foods typical of the day were prohibited. In Darwin's words, he was simply not allowed to eat anything good.
Nothing good.
Significantly, Gully also took Darwin off the many medications that were then routinely prescribed, often in combination. As these compounds often included mercury, laudanum, and other questionable substances, it's once again small wonder that after only a few months, Darwin reported that he felt returned to, quote, almost perfect physical health, end quote, and resumed his scientific work again. Whether it was elements in the water, the rest, improved cleanliness, or simply the cessation of daily doses of toxins that contributed to improvements in health, the at least occasionally beneficial effect of different waters of subterranean origin were well documented by the 19th century. To this day, most folks would agree that sometimes the best thing for you is a good hot soak in a tranquil environment. It does feel good. But how did the water work its magic? Now up in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, there are dozens of springs once renowned for healing properties. They can be of widely different temperature and had similarly different effects. They were given descriptive names such as warm springs, hot springs, sweet springs, salt springs, white sulfur springs, red sulfur springs, you get the idea. Many spas were built up around the different springs to accommodate the increasing flow of visitors, becoming something of a local draw. These resorts became genuinely popular with socialites in the decades preceding the Civil War. Now, the underlying geology of the area consists of sedimentary rock created long ago by countless generations of marine organisms leaving their shells behind them, ultimately forming layers of carbonate that thickened into beds of limestone, calcium carbonate, and dolomite, calcium magnesium carbonate. Many millions of years later, tectonic forces raised these seabeds, tilted and fractured them, and after eons of erosion, a segment remained between the harder granitic Blue Ridge Mountains and the Appalachians, creating the wide Shenandoah Valley. Abundant surface water seeps down into the many fractures. If the fracture is not very deep, the water will stay cool and will flow back out where the pressure and elevation allow, as a cold spring. As you might suspect, water that flows farther and deeper through the earth begins to absorb geothermal heat, and it is thought that the hotter springs probably circulate water around a mile deep, before pressure again makes the water flow up to the surface. That the depth of circulation accounts for temperature differences will likely sound straightforward enough, and this also explains the differing chemistry of hot and cold springs. Progressive amounts of potassium and sodium are leached into groundwater the longer it circulates, and this is also how sulfur is added. One mineral found in limestone we know is gypsum, which we use as sheetrock for housing, among other things. Gypsum is technically calcium sulfate, and in flowing water, it will dissolve into its separate constituent components, calcium and sulfate. Drink enough water with dissolved calcium magnesium sulfate, and you will find out that it is a very effective laxative, which would be just the thing for someone suffering from constipation. A similar process occurs in cold springs running through limestone, which is technically calcium carbonate. The calcium separates from the carbonate. The carbonate bonds with loose hydrogen ions from the water. And bingo, you have a spring chock full of dissolved calcium bicarbonate, which will have the same effect as an Alka-Seltzer or Tums if you drink a sufficient amount. Now, you might be wondering why the bicarbonate wouldn't also collect in the warmer spring, but as temperature increases, calcium carbonate actually decreases in solubility, and with a longer flow path, more of the loose carbonate will bond back with the loose calcium ions and precipitate out. So the different springs offered distinctly different, if limited, respite from numerous afflictions, and you could see why people would often travel from one spa to the other looking for a cure. But you'd have felt pity for some unlucky sufferers. They'd hobble from one spring to the next, seeking some surcease of pain, not finding reprieve until finally, as many people remarked at the time, they'd literally be down, to their last resort. As the 19th century progressed, medical practices became more science-based and people began to look at springs as sources of recreation rather than healing. But there were other cultural developments and pressures underway that gave new urgency to efforts to scientifically understand groundwater as well, and which ultimately led to the study of hydrogeology as we know it. That will be the subject of our next episode, and I do hope you'll join us. This has been a production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. This is Dr. Chris. Till next time, thanks for listening.